Hello. Everyone knows that listeners to the Napoleonic Quarterly are a forgiving, generally relaxed sort of bunch, which is why it hasn't bothered them too much that the audio quality has sometimes not been as consistent as one might like. But after all, when you're dealing with a range of historians from a range of technological backgrounds and skill sets, let's say, you know, sometimes that's just how it goes. And so listeners will have certainly appreciated the fact that it takes a lot for me to stand up at the beginning of one of these episodes and apologise for poor audio quality, but this is happening for the first time. Yes, it's another first for the Napoleonic Quarterly. The fact of the matter is, for the episode you're about to hear, the record button was not pressed, which is pretty bad. What you're left with is a very bad backup recording. It's not entirely bad. It's listenable to, I'd say. Give it a minute or two to get used to it. And what you're hearing, though, is not the recording itself, but a recording of me listening to the recording, with the occasional opening and closing of a door or entry of a 11-year-old child. However, despite all of this, I hope you enjoy. I've had to edit out a few bits, so apologies to the patrons who were asking some of the questions whose points have had to be omitted. That's too bad. But apologies to Bernie Campbell, who's our presenter for this episode. I'll leave it to Bernie to explain what the idea is behind all this, but bear with it, and it's still all good stuff after all. And remember, if you have any questions or comments based on this, the email is napoleonicquarterly@jubel.com.
Hello and welcome to this episode of the Napoleonic Quarterly, where we take the Napoleonic period in 3-month chunks at a time with a number of special episodes in between to fill the gaps and to provide new information that perhaps we don't get a chance to get to in the main episodes. My name is Bernie Campbell. It's my pleasure to be sort of in the chair for this episode that is a little different. We just went through a sequence with a zoom in on several of the major battles of the year 1800. In this episode, we're going to try and zoom out and take in the world beyond the titanic struggle in Europe between France and the coalition. And to try and, my vision was to go a little bit around the horn, as it were, to examine what's been going on or what is going on in other parts of the world. Hopefully we can get some contributions from Professor Alexander Makiparidze, who's here today with us. Professor Esdale is not with us at the moment. We're still hoping he may appear, but we'll see. And I know that we have a number of our Patreons and other panelists who have joined us from around the globe who will pepper us with questions and perhaps be able to lend their expertise to this as well. And so we are in the turn of the century. We are just entering the 19th century here in the podcast. We are about to release the episode on, we're recording this. We haven't yet released the episode on quarter three, but that's in the pipeline to come very shortly. The world population in 1800 is just under 1 billion people, of which only about 200 million of them live in Europe. So there is a large view of the world that is not in our purview, but will have an impact in many ways on what's happening in Europe, and Europe will have an impact on what's happening there. Just to kind of get us started, I thought we would take a quick look at what's been happening in North America, perhaps. And speaking for myself, since that was what I studied in school, we have an ongoing presidential election in the year of 1800. And I say ongoing because in that time period, the United States didn't have a formalized single election day. And the electors for the election of 1800 were chosen throughout the summer, spring and summer of 1800, culminating in the fall with the final election, which would be something to behold in 1800, as it led to a tie in the Electoral College between Thomas Jefferson and Aaron Burr, which would ultimately be decided in the House of Representatives by congressmen in the House of Representatives, which would ultimately swing to Thomas Jefferson. But what makes the election of 1800 very interesting is it is really the first recognizable modern election in U.S. history, with a lot of the features that we have unfortunately become accustomed to with mudslinging and propaganda and other efforts to try and sway the election. A number of parties changed their, a number of states changed their method for choosing electors to benefit one party or another, which again, something we're a little familiar with, unfortunately. So that's been happening in North America. There's a treaty that we'll be talking about in the main episode that will move Louisiana from Spain back to France. That's coming later on this year in the podcast. I'm sure there'll be more to talk about that later. But that's going to have significant ramifications on the North American world in the long term. Anything, Alex, anything that you might like to add to kind of an overview of North America in 1800?
Well, we all like books, so I guess we have to mention that, if my memory is correct, in April of 1800, the Library of Congress is established, which will become a preeminent institution, a place I love doing research at.
So that's an important point. We're going to see that established here in the New World, as it were. I've been there once on a trip to Washington, D.C. It's someplace I'd love to go back there someday, spend a little bit more time.
You know, I'm working on the New History of Louisiana Purchase, which you alluded to, Bernie. And, of course, Jefferson's library is at the Library of Congress. And it is rather displayed in this wonderful round kind of room. So if you ever have the rest of our listeners, if they have a chance to visit it, I highly recommend it, because it'll get a sense of how Jefferson organized his books, kind of his own kind of cataloging system, but also get a sense of breadth of interest that he had.
Excellent. Alex, British Alex, Quartermaster General Alex.
That always makes me laugh. But Alex, I didn't know you were working on this on this book. You're very prolific. But is it going to be another a great big wodge of a title, a sort of akin to Kutuzov, or is it going to be a slimmer volume?
I don't think I'm capable of slim volumes. at least that's what people tell me.
So this,
the publisher certainly hopes it will be a slim volume. That the more I dig. The more I write and work on it, I realize that there is a lot to be said, not just about, you know, one of the issues with Louisiana Purchase with the historiography is that much of it is, from American point of view, insular. So it's written from the American perspective, or at least the books are about the American experiences. What I'm trying to do is to look at for the colonial experience with Spain, France, Britain, and of course, United States. Why would Louisiana be given away by the French repeatedly? Or why would Spain be interested in giving it up in 1800? In order to understand it, you need to dig a little bit deeper. And so right now, actually, I'm just going through Louis XIV's period, and kind of getting an understanding of what is the colonial point of view, why is this territory is important? And it is.
Well, that's fantastic. It's great timing as we approach this great period when the Louisiana Purchase is going to be such a big deal. And actually, as I start to look at what we're going to do for 1802 and 1803, we are going to be making the most of this, absolutely. So that's very exciting. But we can't have you on to talk about it and be the professor as well. So this is the problem.
I can't double dip, huh?
I know. This is the problem we have with Charles for the entire Peninsular War. How we cope with that is going to be a big problem. Anyway, back to you, Bernie. Thanks.
Thank you, Alex, and thank you, Alex, for that wonderful overview of your work. I'm going to find that fascinating when it finally arrives to enjoy. I did a lot of reading on the early Republic as one of my college classes when I was a young stripling at Washington and Lee University once upon a time. And that was one of the classes I took with Dr. Merchant. So that was that'll be an interesting period. So that's North America. We've got some things going on with territories. I did a quick dive into just to kind of look and see what might have been happening in Canada in this time period. And other than the assimilation of French Canadians into British administration, sort of an ongoing process, not too much there. But Latin America, on the other hand, south of the United States, there is a lot of stirrings going on as revolutionary ideals from France and elsewhere, the United States, begin to filter into the Spanish colonies. And that will have an impact, you know, a little bit later on, as Alex, Quartermaster General Alex, alludes to the Peninsular War. When things begin changing with the Spanish crown, those revolutionary ideas that are beginning to filter in to Spanish society, the Creoles, who are excluded from political life within the context of the Spanish colonies, but they have wealth and they have ability and they get educations in Europe, but are forbidden from participating in the political life by the Peninsulares, who are the ruling class in the Spanish colonies. You're going to have a lot to say about that. And one of the greatest of the Creoles, actually, in the year 1800, arrives in Europe for education. That would be Simón Bolívar, arrives for the first time in Europe in 1800. And that will have some ramifications for Latin America later on, as he will eventually return to the Latin American colonies, particularly the captaincy of Venezuela, as it was called, and will have an impact on that, as well as Colombia and a number of others in Latin America. So there's a lot of revolutionary ferment, and I haven't even spoken about Haiti yet, because we will be visiting with Haiti significantly in the mainstream of the podcast later on, but there's a lot to be said for the revolutionary efforts there. Anything to add to kind of that overview, Alex?
No. I think as you've said, our episodes, forthcoming episodes, will explore a lot of interesting, aspects of the imperial colonial world, so to speak. Since much of, we oftentimes forget how huge, really Spanish America, Spanish colonial empire is at this time. It stretches from Texas all the way to the tip of Argentina. So there's a lot of diversity of experience, diversity of aspiration, and you'll see that all play out, not just in this year, but starting with this year, increasingly we see the diversity of response to the revolutionary and ultimately Napoleonic challenge.
Yeah. Estimated, just to go back to sort of that population comment, you know, the world's approaching 1 billion. 7 million live in Northern America, but 24 million live in Latin America. And that just gives you a kind of picture of how important and large that world is. You know, we don't sometimes realize how massive those territories are. They don't sometimes get the attention they deserve. Swinging around, and we're moving to areas that perhaps are outside my own experience a little bit, you have the question of Africa, south of the Sahara, where there are peoples who are being greatly impacted by Europeans coming in. The Atlantic slave trade is still going on with its tragic results. But there are colonial conflicts, not only with regards to the slave trade and conflicts in Africa. You're also seeing a number of frictions developing in southern Africa, particularly South Africa, the Cape Colony, that will later bear fruit in the later part of the 1800s between English settlers and Dutch settlers. And that colony will pass back and forth between England and the Dutch several times during the Napoleonic period. And so the seeds of those conflicts are coming around, as well as we move into this period. And that's a theater, that's an area that perhaps doesn't always play into the main narrative of our story in the Napoleonic Wars, but it will have consequences. With regards to the slave trade, you're already seeing, you know, to bring it back to Europe, you're already seeing the movements under people like William Wilberforce to ban the slave trade from England. The United States will be moving towards banning the slave trade before we finish the first decade of the 1800s. The earliest moment is allowed by the U.S. Constitution that was agreed to by during one of the compromises. And so we're already seeing a movement towards the end of that practice that will play out throughout the rest of the 1800s, but will also be important because as we look at the Napoleonic period, we look at, coming back to the question of Haiti, this, you know, effort at first, you know, to abolish slavery by the French Republic, and we haven't quite gotten there with Napoleon, but Napoleon will be attempting to reinstitute that institution in the French colonies a little bit later on. So that's an area of the world that is going to be impacted by the actions of Europeans as well.
One of the very useful projects is a project entitled Slave Voyages, which is a massive database which takes the data of individual voyages by country, by year, and makes it publicly available, slavevoyages.org. And if you you can go through by each year, and you'll see, for example, that in 1800, 77,000 slaves were sold that year alone. A vast majority of them went to the Caribbean, Brazil being the second destination. But that database is very interesting just to kind of break down both the origins and the destination of the people who were removed from Africa and sold into slavery.
So we've got moving a little bit to the north, an area that I read about in your book, Alex, the Ottoman Empire under the reign of Selim III and his attempts at reform, which will essentially end with the end of his rule, which is coming relatively soon in this period. But they are the Ottomans in southern Europe and in Western Asia are a people that are attempting to hang on to a very large area of territory that is becoming increasingly difficult to do. And they are going to struggle to try and hang on to that. And we're seeing some of those struggles already in the year 1800.
Absolutely. I think for the Ottoman world, this is a period of transition, a transition that is full of political, economic, to a degree, social upheaval. Selim's reforms will produce tremendous challenges for the existing really order of the way, and of course his efforts to create Nizami Jadid forces, which are the troops, the Ottoman troops that are trained, and led on in European style. Well, that military reform necessitates additional resources, and in order to create those resources, the Sultan also needs to introduce essentially reforms in finance and in tax collection, creating a separate system of Nizami-e-Redid, which at its core challenges the traditional interests. So this is the interests of the Janissaries, the old standing military elite, or the interests of the religious elite, the ulamas. And so throughout this period, it's, you know, especially the ones that we've been discussing, Ottoman Empire is grappling with tremendous challenges. These challenges are made worse by the fact that Ottomans are facing outside pressure. And my good friend Virginia Aksan published a really interesting study of the Ottoman Empire into this period, and she famously titles it Empire Besieged, and is indeed a reflection of the host of challenges, both domestic, the ones that I alluded to, but also external. This is the period in which Ottoman Empire is facing not only the traditional conflict with Russian Empire, right? They fought with Russians in 1730s, 60s, 70s. The last war has just ended in 1792. But now in this period, they're also facing pressure from France, right? Napoleon's invasion of Egypt creates a change in the paradigm where if French were the allies of Ottoman Empire, well, now they are effectively their rivals. And for the first time, in a remarkable turn, Ottomans and the Russians are actually allied to contain the French threat. So you see combined kind of these joint operations of the Russian and Ottoman fleet in the Mediterranean Sea. You see the Russian fleet actually passing through the straits and then kind of visiting Constantinople. And so all of these are important changes. For Selim, however, these are changes that are not necessarily auguring well. And as you alluded to, Bernie, he only has really 7 years left to rule, to govern, and to live. And so we'll be discussing on podcast how much he will accomplish during those 7 years.
All right. So we've got the Ottomans and the Middle East. There are a number of other groups in the Middle East that they're challenging the Ottomans in places like modern day Saudi Arabia, the Arabian Peninsula. We've seen some hints of that, some rebellions going on in that part of the world. Moving a little bit to further to the east, we cross over the Arabian Sea and over to India, where the Governor General there is still Lord Wellesley, brother of Arthur, who we'll hear more from as time goes on in the podcast. Just finished up the latest in a string of wars, the Anglo-Mysore War, I think is the fourth one that finished up in 1799. And there's a continuing Anglo-Maharatha War that will last through this period between the British East India Company and the various princely states like Mysore and Maharatha. Will be part and parcel of this time period because of the French influence in India, or the French attempt to have influence in India is probably the better way of putting it, and an extension of that colonial. But at the same time, you have these princely states and the remnants of the Mughal Empire still existing and trying to carve out a place for themselves despite the growing European presence in India. And so there are things going on there in the background, trying to, in many cases, trying to find a way to exist outside of European influence, which becomes increasingly difficult to do as the Europeans become more powerful in this period. And the company, the East, and by which I mean the East India Company, becomes more and more the dominant power on the subcontinent in general. I know you wrote about a little bit about this in your book, Alex. When I read it, it was very enjoyable to read through this section. So anything to kind of elaborate on that?
No, I have a grievance though, Bernie. I'm gonna complain.
be my guest.
Because you skipped over Caucasus in Iran.
I did indeed. And
unless you are planning to go back and kind of saving the precious.
Well, I perhaps was too hasty in moving east, but we can circle back around to speak of the Persians and their descendant states and the influence in the Caucasus. I was going to come back round. The goal was to sort of swing back round via Western or Eastern Russia and come back around after swinging through the Far East. But we can visit with them. I'd love to hear your kind of summary of what's been happening or what the state of play, as Quartermaster General Alex would say, is in that part of the world in 1800.
Absolutely, because like in the Ottoman case, Iran is also in a moment of important kind of transition in its history. We have to bear in mind that late 18th century was a period of tremendous upheaval in Iranian history. Ever since the death of Nadir Shah back in 1747, Iran is in fluctuation and torn by the rivalries between tribal leaders. And you'll see kind of the rise of different challengers, you know, Karim Khan and others. Ultimately, the struggle ends in 1790s with Muhammad, Agha Muhammad Khan of the Qajar tribe consolidating power. But one of the first things Agha Muhammad Khan did is essentially embarked on this quest of making Iran great again, right? It's kind of the tapping the imperial narrative of Iran. And to do so, he targeted the Caucasus as a traditional sphere of influence of Iran, where Russia was making great strides. And so in 1795, there's a major invasion by Iranians of Georgia, my homeland. In fact, my hometown of Tbilisi will be razed to the ground by the Iranians after they defeat the Georgian army in September of 1795. And the reason why this is kind of the story is important is because Georgians at this time had an military alliance with Russia. And under this military alliance, Russians were supposed to send troops and help them against Iran. That help did not materialize until after Iranians left. So that was kind of a grievance towards the Russians among the sort of Georgian elites. But Agha Muhammad Khan didn't live long enough after this invasion. A year and a half later, he's assassinated. And so we again, right, have kind of a political turmoil in Iran. But it is short-lived. Agha Muhammad Khan is replaced by Fath Ali Shah, and I encourage listeners to Google him, because that's the man with a remarkable beard, and as one British historian put it, a waspish weight. But that beard is something to behold. But if you're Fath Ali Shah and you come to power in June of 1797, you have a lot of challenges on your hand, not the least of them being the fact that Russians are establishing themselves in the Caucasus. And to get closer to the year that we're discussing, in 1800, in December actually of 1800, the last sovereign Georgian king died. And so the Georgian kingdom will be torn between the rival groups, which will allow Tsar Paul, Emperor Paul of Russia, to decide to kind of shove all of them aside and claim the kingdom for himself. And so indeed, in 1801, as you'll see, we'll be talking about this in our forthcoming episodes, Russia declares that Georgia is annexed. And so that sets the stage for this clash between Russian and Iranian interests, each of them trying to find support outside. And so our podcast will be effectively dealing with the issues that are starting in 1800.
Quartermaster General.
Sorry, Bernie. The problem, though, Alex, is in our planning meeting for 1800 and 1801, you passed up the opportunity to have a segment on Georgia. And given what you've just said, maybe that was a big mistake.
No, it was unspoken that they will have a separate bonus episode.
Well, we will be able to copy.
Alex, I saw it in your eyes. So
well, when it comes to that episode, of course, we do have that flexibility, don't you? I ask you, what's the biggest deal in this 3 months? And it has been known, as with Marengo, that sometimes that section lasts half an hour or so. Maybe that's what's going to happen again. We'll see. Okay.
There's nothing wrong with that. Continuing around the world, we have the Eastern Asian powers, China and Japan. China is in the midst of the Qing dynasty, which began in the 1640s and would be the last Chinese dynasty. It would last until the overthrow of the monarchy in 1912. And China is dealing with a much more aggressive West in the 1800s, although much of that is yet to come. The East India Company is beginning to put more and more pressure on China for trade. and to entice China into a world economy, which they are reluctant to join. As I tell my students when we study this period, although not in great depth, it's a mile wide and inch deep, generally what we cover, is that China had nothing China produced everything they thought they needed, and they didn't want to buy European things. And that will have some significant consequences later in the 1800s that are beyond the scope of our podcast by a great deal. But that will open up the burning British desire to find a trade good that the Chinese will actually buy. And that will have some unfortunate consequences down the road, as many of us will be aware. But what is important and actually is already happening in this time period that will become of a growing consequence is that because of the Chinese insistence on not trading, they will insist on cash for everything. And that will become more an acute problem for Europeans as silver from Spanish mines, but also elsewhere, is draining into the Chinese economy, which will cause some currency issues for Europe, but also currency issues for Japan, as it will create some China will create some inflationary issues there as well, as they accumulate hard currency at a growing rate, although the China trade is only really just beginning from the perspective of Europe, what it will become in the middle of the 1800s, certainly. Anything to elaborate on there that I've missed, Alex?
Yes, just maybe a couple of points. And I think we've touched upon it a little bit in our main podcast. But of course, this is the time, as you, Bernie, mentioned, when Britain is actively seeking to open up Chinese market. In the 1790s, the British government sent first formal embassy to China. George Macartney arrives in 1792, asking the Chinese for rights similar to those enjoyed by the Portuguese in Macau. And of course, Portuguese have a long-standing presence in Macau, which allows them to trade there. Macartney was also to ask for free trade in Canton, including purchasing Chinese goods at market price from whoever the British chose. So, and we know that the British ambassador, the envoy, did meet Emperor Qianlong, but he got nothing from him except for essentially a gift of calligraphy. And that in itself is interesting, because that meeting between British embassy and the Chinese emperor, of course, in many respects is overshadowed by the disagreements on kowtow ritual, right? The ritual requiring an individual to kneel with both knees on the ground and to touch, and bow as if to touch the head to the ground, which from Macartney's point of view represented a very serious dilemma, since he didn't want to admit any inferiority on the part of Great Britain. And so that in itself, for a reader, and I mean, the readers who are interested, they can read it and find, you know, to get a good understanding of the British sensibilities too. I love, you know, kind of as a spoiler, of that Macartney ultimately refuses to do a kowtow, but he agrees to genuflect, which is essentially a one knee quick, right, the curtsy. Where one knee there briefly touches the ground as if he was doing it in front of his own sovereign. So, but the related issue to that is that even though Macartney got nothing in 1792-93, the British refused to give up. And as we will see in the forthcoming episodes, they would kind of change their tactic. And they will be pressuring Portuguese increasingly to give them the British greater presence in the Portuguese colony of Macau. Of course, at this time, right, Portugal becomes caught between the French and the British, with the Spanish increasingly allied or taking a French position. We'll talk about the conflicts that Portuguese find themselves in. And you will see that in 1801, the British will actually try to take over Macau, which will be an interesting episode to delve in.
All right. Good. So across the Sea of Japan, Japan is in the midst of the Tokugawa shogunate, currently under the rule of Emperor Kokaku. I'm unsure of my pronunciation, so I apologize if I did not pronounce that correctly. And they are looking through a period of, they've just come through a period of reform in the 1790s to try and address a series of peasant uprisings and discontent among the samurai and daimyo class, which had led to, inhibited economic growth, but peasant uprisings because of the lack of food and higher prices. So just like European countries and other parts of the world, when there's not enough food, peasants tend to get a little rowdy. But that being said, by the year 1800, Japan had 5 cities with over 100,000 residents, 3 among the world's 20 cities that had over 300,000. And it's quite possible that Edo may have been the world's largest city with a population of over 1 million in the year 1800. And so there's things that will be happening there, even though they are not necessarily directly part of our narrative between France and the coalition powers at various times. There is a growing population and a growing power in Japan as well in 1800. So that's a little bit of briefly what's been happening in Japan as far as the year 1800 goes. Anything to kind of chip in on that, Alex?
No, I unfortunately, I'm not as familiar with Japanese history. I do want to mention one thing, and that is that Western intrusions would only increase starting in early 19th century. And of course, this is a period in a special little bit after the year that we're talking, when Russian merchants, fishermen, and ultimately warships will start encroaching on Karafuto, the island of Karafuto, or what the Russians called Sakhalin, or still do. And of course, by 1804, 1805, and I'm looking at our Alex, if he will flex his muscle and shut me for spoiling the story. But of course, by 1804, 1805, these encroachments will turn violent, and there will be actually violent confrontations between the Russians and the Japanese.
All rules are suspended for these non-main episodes.
So right. Excellent.
I was worried there.
It's free excellent. And easy. Yeah, go for it.
One other note in Asia before we come back around to Europe to kind of touch base. And we did have a question via email that's very good that I want to get to here. But one other note, and I'm not conversant in Australian history, but one note that I did pick up, which I find very interesting, is the year 1800 is the first year that John MacArthur, a pretty significant figure in Australian history, sends back the first samples of merino wool from Australia to England for testing, and sort of the foundation of the great wool industry that will be the backbone of that land for so long as part of the British Empire. We think of Australia, and we think of the First Fleet, and we think of the convicts, but very quickly after the turn of the 1800, into the 19th century, after the turn of 1800, you're going to see that becoming an increasingly valuable part of the British Empire, not for the disposal of populations that England would prefer not to have on board, but for wool, which will help drive the Industrial Revolution in England. And of course, there will be the discovery of gold and some other precious metals and stones in Australia, but those will become secondary to the much larger wool trade over time. I don't know if Australia factors on your radar very much, Alex. But...
not really, but I do know one thing. I think it is in 1800 that the Catholic priests, for example, and some Irish, they are Irish, of course, from the priests who were convicted in the complicity in the Irish Rebellion of 1798. I know that they were delivered to Australia into exile in 1800. And so here we can kind of connect it to Australia being as both a penal colony, but also to the events in Europe where the Irish aspirations connected to the Australian exile.
All right, so we kind of looked to the broader world a little bit, but one coming back to Europe and bringing our focus back to into Europe. This was a question that we had from Rob Coughlin, one of our Patreons. There's the sense that Europe has been fighting and France has been fighting for almost a decade. They had been in the fight for a very long time. Surely, as the question goes, I'll read it. The point was made of the war-weariness of France as Bonaparte came to power, and this is very understandable given that France has been fighting for almost a decade. But I thought to myself, what about Britain? What about Austria? Of the European powers, they had been in the fight too for just as long. Surely continued warfare was having social and economic effects on them. What were the political ramifications in Austria and elsewhere? I know half the answer concerning Britain and, of course, the coming of the Addington government. But the question sort of boils down to, what's the war weariness of the various European powers and regions as they sit after Marengo? And this is going to touch on some things that I think are coming up in the main episode. But can we kind of have sort of a summary of, or maybe talk a little bit about how these various countries are sitting in terms of their, man, we've been fighting this for so long. What are the attitudes? Have attitudes shifted? And I know we've got David on the call here, and he may be able to provide some insight as well into some of these questions, and feel free to chime in, David, as we kind of address what's the general feeling about the war as we come to 1800. I mean, it's been 1789 was the French Revolution, so we've been at this for 11 years now. Which one of you wants to start out? Alex, you
want to... Yeah, I think, David, you start with Austria, and I can certainly chime in on the Russian side, because the question has a part of an answer in it, in that all of these countries do feel the burden of the war, and not necessarily only the war against France, right? The European powers are engaged in conflicts outside France, the one involved in France. And they do try to reform in order to bear the costs of war. So, David, you take the Austrians, and I'll deal with the Russians.
Okay, thank you for that. There's a number of sort of forces at work here. I mean, certainly there's obviously war weariness from the casualties and that sort of thing, and that's causing problems with agricultural production, particularly in the East. Where it's essentially an agricultural economy. The industrial stuff is in Bohemia, that's now the part of the Czech Republic and Austria proper. But the main things really is the Austrian answer to financing the war was essentially to print more of what was called the Bankersettel, which is paper money. But most of it's unbacked, so you're starting to get inflation. It's starting to creep into the economy, and this will get steadily worse as the next 15 years or so goes on. The other things are really there's a kind of political shift at two levels because of the losses of territory in Italy and Germany. And of course, this would happen more as the time went on. There's a greater burden on Hungary, Galicia, Croatia, these places. And of course, in return, the local magnates, particularly in Hungary, are looking for more political power, more concessions from the central government. So it's causing a big strain there. And of course, then the question is, how do you deal with all this? It's clearly the old structures are not working. The old team, Thugut and Teague, who was the president of the Hofkriegsrat, have failed in the eyes of the emperor. And so the whole lot is going to get swept away. But what do you replace it with? And what you'll see is Charles attempting to create a new form of government. So there's less kind of burden on Francis. They sweep a lot of the old generals away and all this kind of thing, but there's then a struggle between the reformers and the people who, the more conservative elements, to who's got their hands on the levers of power. And we'll see that play out during 1801 when Charles gets his reforms there. But as regards sort of revolutionary movements, not too many issues. There's a few of them go out, get drunk, dance around the Tree of Liberty, that sort of thing. There are some problems with Serbian troops because, of course, they're Greek Orthodox, and so they look to Russia to some extent. And of course, you've got the first stirrings of the what will become the Serb rebellion against the Turks. They're kind of overblown a little bit by sort of nationalist historians. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of really just the case of Austria is exhausted and really can't stop the French and the Russian involvement in Germany as well. So not in a position to resist, so they're going to lose ground there as well.
All right, thank you, David. Alex, you want to talk a little bit about Russia?
Oh, yeah. I like Austrians who effectively feel the brunt of the war directly in the sense that the territories that they rely on are directly affected by the war. Russians are, of course, far removed from the immediate conflict with France. But the fact that the Russians organize expeditions to Italy, to Netherlands, to Hanover, right? All of this, of course, requires a lot of expense and lays a heavy burden on the Russian budget. I should not forget also that Russia is engaged in multiple conflicts at this time. So it's not only the war against France, and I'm looking more broadly, that span of a decade. The question alluded to, but it's also the war against the Turks, the war against Sweden. War against Iran in 1796, right? The Russian Expeditionary Corps marches all the way to the Caspian Sea and fights the Persians. So all of this requires enormous expense. And so when Empress Catherine passed away in November of 96, she left behind plenty of problems, both structural, and long-term, and short-term. So her son, Paul, actually tried to deal with those issues. He tried to drag Russia out of the state of economic malaise that it has fallen during the last years of his mother's reign. So how did he, what did he do? One of the first things he did is he tried to curb inflation. And he did so by severely restricting circulation of the paper money. And David and I alluded to that as well. But maybe not as dramatically as Austrians didn't do it as dramatically as Russians, where on Paul's orders, millions of paper rubles were actually publicly burned outside the palace in St. Petersburg to tell people that we literally are getting rid of paper money. The minting of silver rubles are ordered, but there will be issues there as well. Tsar, for example, supports the creation in 1799. He supports the creation of a Russian American company, or the famous or infamous, however you want to look at, in order to start trade with United States, or more precisely, to develop colonial projects in North America, and then Alaska being famous for being the area of the operations for this company. He also supported the establishment of the credit bank that would lend money to the nobility as a way of kind of propping up that social hierarchy. Furthermore, of course, we know that Paul didn't live long enough, right? He passed away in 1801. And then his son, when he comes to power, of course, has to grapple with the problems that his grandmother and his father left him. Partly, Alexander was fortunate that his father launched the military reforms that got rid of a lot of dead weight, right? As much as we sometimes read in books that you know, Paul's reforms were misguided. When it comes to military reforms, they were very pretty targeted, right? They were designed to increase the efficiency of the Russian force, trim down the officer corps, which was tremendously bloated. You can look at, you know, if you look at the guard regiments, the statistics there in terms of the ratio between the officers and the soldiers is just stunning, where the officers far outnumber the soldiers themselves, at least if you count everyone who is on books. So those in the army reforms are quite important, both in order to maintain the battle readiness and efficiency in war, but also to trim down the costs. But what Alexander did, kind of to look at, to answer the question, is that he understood the need to deal with these structural challenges. And so one of the first set, first tasks that he sets for himself is restructuring the Russian government. His decision to organize the unofficial committee, right, of several of his friends, who together kind of collectively discuss the structural reforms, are important because it is here in 1802, they conceive and carry out a remarkable program of centralizing and streamlining the Russian administrative system, creating ministries. And so modern day Russian ministries actually trace their history back to the 1802 reform, where the Ministry of War is created, Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Ministry of the Economy, and all that, right? And those were designed to increase kind of efficiency of the Russian government in order to deal with the challenges that Russia is facing because of the legacy of a decade full of war. Now, one thing, actually, last point, one reform that they seriously considered but didn't carry out, maybe unlike Austrians, is the constitutional reform. They've talked about adopting, and when I say they, it's Alexander, it's Adam Czartoryski, a rather famous advisor to him, it's Count Viktor Kochubey, Paul Stroganov, Nikolai Novosiltsev, right, these kind of members of an official committee, who were moderate liberals, I would say, certainly by the Russian standards, and who wanted to consider a possibility of not only restructuring the administrative machinery of the Russian state, but also more fundamentally restructuring Russian state along constitutional lines. And so they've talked about drafting a fundamental law that would have transformed, if it had adopted, you know, if it had happened, would have transformed Russia into something more akin to a constitutional monarchy. Now, that reform was kind of postponed and ultimately never carried out. Similar fate befell essentially the reform dealing with serfdom, one of the enormous kind of social evils that the Russian society suffered from, the reform of serfdom was also constrained by the fact that Alexander was well aware of what happens to rulers who push reforms too far, who push this agenda too far. Right? His own father was assassinated. And so what he did is he significantly curtailed the serfdom reform. He applied emancipation only in the royal domains. And so we see emancipation of serfs picking a pace in the years to come. But the serfdom as such will not be abolished in Russia for another 60 years.
Unfortunate that we see that pattern not only in Russia but elsewhere, where people who are really committed to reform tend to make themselves targets for counter-reform, and that's a theme that we see in history. Unfortunately, there is some of you may be familiar with the American YouTube series the American YouTube author John Green puts on called Crash Course. I use quite a bit in some of my high school classes, and he has this segment in one of the episodes where he says, "Oh, look, it's a collection of my favorite assassinated moderates." And, it's dangerous being a moderate. To address Rob's question, with regards England, we know that the Addington government is coming. There's a lot going on in the waning days of the Pitt administration, particularly, and some of which has nothing to do with the war except perhaps tangentially, with the Act of Union coming and the unification of Ireland to the Kingdom of Great Britain. And part of that was brought on by the war, the attempts by the French to spur the Irish to uprising on a number of occasions in the 1790s. Pitt believing that the only way to secure Ireland was to unify it with England. But the question then came about, you know, Catholic emancipation, which is ultimately what will help contribute to the bringing down of his first administration here. You know, the disagreements over whether or not Catholics should have full political rights within the English institution, and ultimately George III saying, no, we're not going to do that. There's economic issues with that as well, political issues, and it's tied with the war, but also tied with the growing unrest. It's not unrest in a grand sense, but the growing unease of the English working class, or the British working class, rather, as we're starting to see sort of those first sort of tentative steps towards an industrial revolution in England. And Charles isn't here to kind of speak on this in greater detail, unfortunately. But there is kind of a sense in the early 1800s, the dawn of the 19th century, that we're starting to see some of that unease with economic issues in the United Kingdom, in Great Britain as well. So that's part of the parcel.
Yeah, I mean, if nothing else, it is 1799. Right, 1800 period is when William Pitt is introducing first income tax, introduces window tax, right? And all those new taxes are required because of the pressures of a decade-long conflict against France.
All right, so we've kind of done a pretty good job of sort of circling around the globe here and giving sort of an overview. I'd like to open up the floor to anybody who might have questions that we haven't touched on that they'd like to bring for us to kick around for a little bit. We have a number of our Patreons here today, and we'll take a few minutes anyway, and perhaps open the floor to questions from the gallery, as it were. And I see a hand, Alan. Would you like to share your question with us today?
Yeah, thank you. It's great to be an active participant or listener with all these experts, and I continue to contribute to the Mikhaberidze household finances by buying every book that the man writes.
Oh, and, make a space for that new book on Louisiana.
Yeah, I started. I reached for my wallet when you said that.
Thank you, Alan. I appreciate your support.
I know that there will be plans to talk about Haiti, but I'm really curious about the Great Game. I'm at that part of the book, Alex, where you're talking about the rivalry between Great Britain and Russia and what's happening in that part of the world, Persia, etc. So I'm curious how much of that was influencing European politics, and then also just a little bit more about the plans for the Haitian Revolution, which has always been a deep interest to me.
I think so here there are a couple of kind of ways you can look at the Great Game, and I try to kind of discuss that in the book. One is, of course, the dimension of the Franco-British rivalry. And as I point out in the book, a lot of things that the British did in India, a lot of things that they did in the Middle East, is the response to what they believed was the French threat. This is especially clear if you read the correspondence of the Governor General of the British East India Company, if you read the correspondence with the Board of Control, especially if you going to look at the letters of Henry Dundas, who supervised, right, or who was in charge of the Board of Control. Granville, the Foreign Secretary of Britain, is less convinced that there is this French threat, but the company was certainly convinced of this. And so here in 1799, in 1800, 1801, we see a very proactive, I think, I'll put it this way, very proactive policy that the British East India Company follows, and that includes sending expeditions to Oman, to what is today Yemen, embassies, British embassies to Iran, right, 1800, 1801. This is a very crucial point in all this, cultivating relationship with local elites in Arabian Peninsula and beyond in order to stave off the French threat. So that's kind of one dimension. Of course, in India, that threat is actually used to justify the takeover of the local states who present a threat. Bernie alluded to the Anglo-Mysore War. Well, that war is occasioned by this perception that Tipu Sultan is clearly pro-French and that he would be opening his doors to the French arrival. Richard Wells, with the Governor General of British East India Company, only too eager to exploit that. But the second aspect to it is kind of and maybe less, even less pronounced, but still important, is that Russia is part of this great game. Maybe not as active as France. France has presence in India. Or kind of littoral, Indian oceans littoral, while Russian doesn't. But still, the fact that Russia expands its authority into the Caucasus, the fact that at the expense of Iran, the fact that in 1800, 1801, Paul seriously discussed with the French possibility of a expedition, joint expedition to India, is certainly worrisome to the British. To the British interests. And so here, I think in many respects, what we see is some of these threats are overblown, but they are, I think, serious enough to warrant response on the part of Britain, or at least British East India Company. And that response ultimately contributes to the growth of the British imperial power in Asia. As for Haitian Revolution,
I'm actually going to throw it over to the Quartermaster General to speak to the plans to cover this off in the podcast as well.
Shall I just quickly show you the? I brought it down especially. Look, it's the big board. It's the big board for the podcast for 1800 and 1801. So this is the current season. We did this in the planning meeting. And you can see, hang on, I'll quickly show you. So we've got, you actually probably can't see it, can you? But basically, this is quarter three, 1801. And what I want to do there is a 10-minute segment on Haiti, which would be looking back at most of, you know, the last 5-6 years, how Toussaint's government was going. Then we move to, and of course, that's the 3 months, I think, where the constitution is signed off. Well, you know, he just kind of does it and agrees it without France's approval. Then we have the fourth quarter, have another 10-minute segment on it, which would be on looking at the French view, Napoleon's WTF, basically. And then off they go. And then this will shock some of you, because I just couldn't help myself. We're going to do a planning meeting for 1802 and 1803. But look, watch this. Behind the big board, I've got a secret little board, a couple of little boards. You can't read them. I just couldn't help myself. I totally got into it a few weeks ago. Which is terrible for my eyes, by the way. It completely messed me up. But and I want to be clear that we will, you know, this is very much a draft. It's not. It's all up for discussion in the planning meeting that we'll do for 1802 and 1803. But for Haiti in particular, which has got to form the narrative backbone, I think, of season six of the Napoleonic Quarterly. You've got the French invasion in the first quarter of 1802, and then the second quarter of 1802, where essentially it sort of peters out. You have that political settlement, Toussaint kind of giving up. Then I think it maybe goes quiet, depending on how desperate we are. There's the option of the call to arms in the final 3 months of 1802. There's a lot to talk about as to what else we have here. And then what else we've got? The second quarter of 1803, there's a there's an agreement at Arkahe, I'm not sure about that, and then Two Sounds Downfall as well, so there's a possibility there. And then, of course, the climactic Battle of Vertier in the final quarter of 1803, ahead of 1st January 1804, boom, the big, big moment. So for me, it's got to be this sort of a key narrative thread for that, you know, for this these next episodes of the Napoleonic Quarterly. So it starts, it'll start with, as I say, with a catch-up. Where are we now? So we've this is the episode that's about to come out. If I can just, oh my gosh, it's in such a tangle, but anyway, that's another story. So actually, we've got a few more to go. Hohenlinden after that, the episode. Then we're moving our way through assassination of Paul. Then the episode on Copenhagen and the War of the Oranges. And then we'll be into Haiti after that. And it's going to be, I think, critical for the Napoleonic Quarterly as a story that will see us through to the beginning of 1804, when our attention will probably return to Europe entirely. But we'll see how we go. Anyway, hopefully that was helpful, Alan.
And I just want to say that thank you, Alan, for the thumbs up. I just want to say that you know, there is some things going on. Haiti's playing a very active role. We didn't touch on the Quasi War in our circle around the sort of non-war war between the United States and France. A number of Haitian forces, particularly the Picaroons, essentially Haitian pirates, are participating in this sort of quasi war against the United States and preying on U.S. shipping in that area of the Caribbean, as the United States and France are at war, but not yet at war in this period as well. So there is some activity there. All right. Well, given that Alex has departed from the scene and we're covered a lot of ground today, we will have a planning meeting coming up soon. I know the Quartermaster General has kind of penciled that in for us to get together again to talk about the planning for our next couple of seasons. And thank you to our Quartermaster General for the opportunity to sort of sit in the chair and be a part of this process. I really appreciate it. It's been a lot of fun. And I want to thank all of you Patreons who joined us today. So on behalf of all of you, and behalf of Alex and David and Charles, who was not able to come, thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.